Hello and welcome back to the Let's Backflip Show Happy Hour. I'm Ryan Fring, co-creative director here at Backflip and Lord of the Podcast. And wow, 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 do we have a fun one for you today. We're hanging with Michael Graff, local Emmy Award-winning writer and director. And we've met him before at Madison Media Professionals and throughout various things. He runs a production company here in town as well. But we actually talked to him about script writing and a script that he's had in the works for a few years and it has had options on it, which means production studios have purchased the rights to produce it. And so just that journey that he's been on, he shares with us what COVID's been like. It's a great time. Michael also lives a little rural, so I think his internet was cutting in and out a little bit. So you'll just have to allow for that a little bit. But the discussion is really, really great and definitely worth it. If you don't already, please do like, subscribe, follow, and leave us a review. That is always so much appreciated, never necessary. Without further ado, this is episode 48, Michael Graff. Hello, and welcome back to another Happy Hour. I'm Ryan Fring, creative director here at Backflip, and joining me, as always, is other creative director, John Shoemaker. Say, hey, John.
Hello.
Hey, John. No, that's, I'm going to write that joke and make you read it. I'm going to make you read it. This is awesome. So today we've got Michael Graff, Emmy Award-winning writer-director. If you are a part of Madison Media Professionals or American Advertising Federation, you've likely been at an event that he's been on a panel for or heard from him. So we're so excited to get to just hang out and talk with him. I actually saw a panel about kind of like special effects in like film, specifically like NASA, like actually recreating realistic flights of those spacecrafts and things in certain movies. And Michael happened to be on that, which is really fun. So let's go ahead and do this. Welcome our guest, Michael. Hey, man, thanks for showing up.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is awesome. So we were talking a little bit about before about technology. You were sharing you live out in the country and your internet might not be so great. I think right now your picture is actually better than mine, because I feel like because of my render delay, I'm like a second delayed on mine because technology, man, it's nuts.
Well, you know, the big secret is like if I'm all pixelated in little squares and everything, that's actually how I look like in real life. So
no, it's fantastic. I mentioned you were on that panel before. And it's, you know, it's fun because You're a local in that you live in the area, but as the title up here says, you're an Emmy Award-winning writer-director. So for those who aren't familiar with you, can you just give us a little bit more about your background?
Sure. I'm not originally from Madison. I moved here a number of years ago. I moved here from Los Angeles, and while I was out there, I actually was not writing or directing. I actually started off in post-production. I was working for a post house, visual effects post house. This will kind of date me. This will explain all the gray hairs under my hat. We did all the special effects for Star Trek: The Next Generation and all the posts on Pee-wee's Playhouse. And I worked on a show on HBO called Tales from the Crypt, which is kind of an anthology horror series. And I also worked on the first couple of seasons of Law and Order. And so my background is kind of in episodic long form storytelling. When I was out there, it's like I didn't go out there to work in post. I didn't want to be an editor. Mm-hmm. And when I had an opportunity, I actually followed a girl here to Wisconsin, which everyone said, oh, don't do that. And they were right, because that relationship didn't work. But I fell in love with Wisconsin and got an opportunity to work for a production company here in town called RW Video. And they gave me a great opportunity to kind of pivot out of post and to start producing and directing and writing, and which was a great opportunity for me. So I did that and then went out on my own and started my own company 4 years later, and started Spot Filmworks. And at the time, most of the work for Spot was all commercial, was all advertising. And I really didn't do a lot of writing because I didn't need to. I was, all the creative was coming from ad agencies. And, but I kind of fell into screenwriting. It was something that I liked doing back in college, never really did it seriously. And a number of years ago, I was, like so much that happens to me, it was kind of serendipity. I was working out at the gym, and some guy came up to me and he's like, "You do that TV thing, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "I have a book that would make a great movie." And he gave me the book, and I read it, and I was like, he's right. It actually would make a good story. And so the first screenplay, I actually co-wrote it with another ad guy here in town, with John Besmer, who's over at Planet Propaganda, and an ad guy, a writer in Milwaukee, Mike Coghill. And the three of us wrote this screenplay called Winter of Frozen Dreams. And it's a true story about this college student at the UW, and she was a straight A student. And this took place like in the late 70s. And her senior year, she dropped out of school to go work at a massage parlor. And while she was there, and it was, one of those massage parlors. And she was there, she'd take out insurance policies on her clientele, and then she'd kill them. And the case was the very first televised courtroom case, murder trial in U.S. history. Her attorney had never lost a case. The DA prosecuting the case had never lost a case. His name was Jim Doyle. This launched his political career. He went on to be governor. Anyway, so we wrote this script, and it got produced, and Mark Twain always said the worst luck a young man can have is having really good luck the first day at the track. And that's kind of what happened. I kind of fell in love with screenwriting. And so and again, it was always kind of in my back's kind of in, I do it kind of on the side. And the last couple of years though, I've really decided that I'd like to pivot more back to my first love of longer format storytelling. So I've been trying to do that for the last couple of years. So I've got another screenplay that was optioned called The Last Indian War. It's a former executive at Disney Studios optioned this year. And that's a true story about a group of Native American Indian kids that were kidnapped by the U.S. military at the turn of the last century, and they were shipped off to a military school. And while they were there, they learned this new game called football, and they went on to win the national championship. So it's kind of a really, really cool. It kind of explains why so many football programs in college and high school are named after Native Americans. But it's a great story. And the national championship game they played, they went undefeated. They had a guy on their team named Jim Thorpe. Their coach was a guy named Pop Warner, and they played the only other undefeated team in the country. And it was, it happened to be the team of players whose parents were responsible for their kidnapping. It was the Army Cadets of West Point. And they had a group, or one of their players on their team was a guy named Dwight Eisenhower. And it's like this crazy story. And most people, even if you're big football fans, you don't know like where like the origin story for football came from. And you talk to Native Americans and they know all about the Carlisle, the name of the school that they were shipped to was the Carlisle Indian School. And Native Americans know all about Carlisle, but most people, non-Indigenous folks, they like, wow, I never heard of this. It's a cool story. So I kind of fell in love with the story. Turns out my mom grew up in Pop Warner's house back in upstate New York, and she and my uncle knew, and my grandfather knew Pop Warner when my mom was a little kid. Mm. So it's kind of a cool story.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I've been at a few events with you, so I've heard some of the backstory. I don't know that I was familiar with the Tales from the Crypt. Right?
Yeah.
I was not familiar with that, and I loved that show as a kid for two reasons. One, you know, the stories were just so much fun, but then two, because it was like, you know, I was being a bit of a rebel, staying up late and watching it, you know, and you're not supposed to be watching it because it's super scary and creepy, and I remember that.
Yeah. Well, again, this dates me, but for any of the post tech nerds, post editor folks out there, the thing that was really unusual with this was the post house I worked at was called the Post Group, and we were the beta test site. Yeah, it was kind of in that era before digital editing happened. And the editing system that we were using was actually LaserDisc based. So we would get all of the dailies for Tales from the Crypt and for Law and Order, and we would we'd have to physically make LaserDiscs in A and a B roll of all the footage, so they could play the LaserDiscs simultaneously and be able to dissolve and cut from one to the other back and forth. And it was a lot, or what other shows did we do? So Tales from the Crypt was one of these shows. And the data, the laser discs were so sensitive, we had to store them in the our company had a sauna for clients. Hmm. We had to store the laser discs in the sauna, or the failure rate was too high. So it was like this crazy mix of like voodoo, high tech kind of weirdness that was, and we were kind of stuck in a corner making laser discs for the shows so they'd be able to edit in a non-linear way.
Oh my gosh. I can only imagine that too. And those who don't know what a laser disc is, are you talking like the big format laser disc, or did you guys have smaller ones?
No, these were big, like LP
yeah.
size laser discs. And it was an interesting thing. There was an earthquake. It was either Tales from the Crypt or Law and Order. And I was getting the edit session prepped. So we were cutting some discs for it. And there, it was during the year that the World Series was in San Francisco, and it was the big San Francisco earthquake. Well, down in Los Angeles, we felt the aftershock from that quake, and it actually the laser disc recorded the aftershock.
Oh my gosh.
And it was weird to pull it out and be able to look at the because the laser is burning, basically burning ones and zeros into the disc. Mm-hmm. And you could see where the laser just went off the track. And just each time there was an aftershock, it was pretty cool.
Oh my gosh. That, and I almost had the opportunity to buy the original Star Wars on LaserDisc, like at a garage sale, but I was like, I don't want to get into LaserDisc. And, you know, that was probably one of the only opportunities I will ever have had to get like one of those original versions, you know.
You know how valuable those are now?
Oh, I'm well aware now.
I had a roommate in college had Star Wars on LaserDisc, and I hope he did. I hope he saved them. I hope he saved it. Yeah. It's got the original ending, too.
Right. You can get into a lot of trouble, though, playing that. You know how valuable this thing might be, game?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this is a happy hour. I do want to share kind of what we're drinking. We never pressure. We just always encourage. I've always kind of got like a Clarb. By the way, I switched cameras because my normal camera was just blowing up. This is actually on my phone, which is really cool, connecting over Wi-Fi. So I've got Clarb here, and I've actually got some stuff from Old Sugar Distillery here. This is the honey liqueur and their Queen Jeanine sorghum whiskey. So little mix there. Sorghum. Yeah, just to, you know, kind of warm up the spirit so I can finish out the day strong.
Nice.
Yeah.
There you go. I had whatever was sitting next to me, Ardbeg single malt Scotch whiskey, 10-year. It may have been a recent Christmas present I just opened.
Oh,
also
nice.
Seeing that in my glass that I got for free at an event that I see you have as well.
Our See the Joy glass. Yeah.
Nice.
That was a fun event. All right. What do you got for us?
I've got a mug full of, we'll call it Irish coffee.
Energy juice. That's fantastic. So we've been working with an indigenous agency for a pipeline doing training. So we've learned a lot more about certainly indigenous history in the U.S. And I remember, I can't remember, was it maybe 2 years ago when you did your, it was a little bit of a writing workshop and a little bit of kind of show and tell on the last Indian War. And you're kind of just walking us through your process on it. And I've just been fascinated by it, like you said, because who knows that story? Like, I never knew that story, and it's amazing. And part of that, now that I've learned a lot more, is, you know, taking those Indian kids or those Native American kids and putting them into boarding schools or re-education schools. And it sounds like that's what this was a part of as well. So I'm super fascinated to kind of see how that turns out. And now that you have it optioned, you said by somebody at Disney?
Yeah, the story, I mean, this has been kind of a, it's been a process. And I've actually been working on this for 10 years now. And I've gone through, the script has gone through a number of rewrites. And it's been almost optioned a couple, well, it was optioned once, and then the producer couldn't do anything with it. And then it was almost optioned two other times, and those kind of fell through. And the challenge that I would hear from the producers from the industry side was, well, first of all, I wrote an epic. I wrote kind of a big budget, historical epic, and those always cost more money to produce. And it was important to me that I write a story from these indigenous kids' point of view. I didn't want to tell it from like their Pop Warner's point of view, or from the guy that ran the military school was a guy named Colonel Pratt. I didn't want to make it like a white man's story. Mm-hmm. And although there are there's good juicy roles in the script for those people, it's not the lead characters, the lead protagonists are not you know, A-list white actors. And that has been a challenge. And
oh wow,
it was in getting it made and finding the financing for it. And it was really interesting. And I thought, like, over the last 4 years, you know, things with going on with, you know, with Standing Rock, with the Lakota in the Dakotas, and with the kids being put in cages at the southern border, you know, even the Washington Redskins dropping their extremely racist name. It's, you know, I thought, you know, this is a really good time for the story to be told. It's just finding the right, kind of the right group of people and the right mix of people. And the producer that I'm working with now, it was funny because the first conversation we had with them, I asked them, so, you know, what do you like about this? And he said, I think the market has caught up to this story. And which I think is really encouraging. So, you know, in Hollywood right now, there's a big push. If you're an old white guy like me, I'm like a dying breed. There's been a real push for diversity, all across the board. I'm also a member of the Directors Guild and, the DGA for the last, well, boy, for the last decade or so has been encouraging diversity among its members. And it's just now starting to bear fruit. So I think the story is ripe for telling. So, you know, it's like 10 years to get to the point where now the story's optioned. And then, so the next step is, the producers are going to put together a package to, they've got a couple of financing sources that they're going to approach, and they'll try to attach some talent and we'll see what happens.
So they option that. Can you describe, for those who don't know what optioning a script is, what that kind of looks like and what that means?
Sure. So a screenplay is it's intellectual property. And in the United States, intellectual property can be bought and sold and rented just like real estate, just like real property. And I think the easiest way to kind of wrap your head around the terms, the difference between an option and a sale of a screenplay, it's like renting an apartment or a condo, or buying a house or buying the condo. An option agreement is a short-term rental of the property that gives rights to be able to shop that property around to try to raise money and attach actors and directors and everything that has to go, just find distribution, all that kind of thing. And then once, if they can put a package together, then they can go and buy the property outright. So it's, so the script right now, it's optioned for 2 years. I'm sorry, I take that back, for 12 months. It's a 12-month option. And then they have a right to renew it like you would with, you know, renewing a rental, the lease on your apartment.
So what would be like the ideal situation here? They figure out financing and are able to get it produced and then come back. And is it something that you still could or would want to still be attached to? Or would you just sell it outright? Or would you just have to see what comes?
I would, for this project, I'd probably sell it outright. Mm-hmm. I have been told in no uncertain terms that, it's too big of a project for a first time feature director. And even though I've been a commercial director for 20 years, making that leap from short form storytelling to long form storytelling, kind of the unwritten rule is, for a first time director, is budgets under 10 million. Mm-hmm. And, this is definitely something that would be a little bit bigger than that. So,
yeah.
So I've come to terms with the fact that this is something that I would write and give to a more established director to do. But I've got a couple other projects that I've been developing that are lower budget that would be good stepping stones for me.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, you know, you're giving perspective on something that I think a lot of people don't know until they hear some of these stories and start to learn more about the industry, is that, you know, you have these projects that you put a lot of passion behind and bring to the market. And then a lot of what you'll be met with is, well, you know, someone might take this and do something with it, but it's not going to be you. One of my former bosses when I was just getting started in my intern days, down in Rock Island, Illinois. He's been a commercial director for, you know, 20, 30 years. And he's very good friends with the man who wrote Road to Perdition.
And oh, yeah.
He worked together. So that's Max Licato, who wrote Road to Perdition. And then he worked together with this friend to write, develop the screenplay for Road to Purgatory, which is kind of the sequel. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, that's been caught in this cycle of like, well, we're interested, but we don't want any of your team working on it. You know, so they've been trying to see if they could do it, but I don't really know where it is at this point.
That is so weird you bring up that particular project, because I know I have a friend in Chicago that is working, I think, with the same guys that you worked with, because he's been trying to raise money for a group of films, and that's one of the projects.
Mm-hmm. So the owner of the company that I worked for, his name is Phil Dingledine, and then he's friends with Max Licato. And I think they did some movies as well that are similar. Now I looked up your Winter of Frozen Dreams. Forgive me if I'm grouping it in the wrong group of things, but I was like, oh, it kind of looks similar to this. This director made a movie called Mother. I think it's kind of like it went on, I think it was Lifetime TV, but it was kind of a horror, Mother's Day horror for you.
Yeah. Well, what you're looking at, if you're looking on IMDb or looking on Netflix at Winter of Frozen Dreams, okay. The movie that got made is not the script that we wrote.
Oh, okay.
I actually, it was actually a really painful lesson to learn. But what got produced, it's funny, my name is attached to it, but what got produced is not the vision and not the story that we set out to tell. And it was heartbreaking at the time to have that happen. And there's an old Hollywood saying, and I didn't hear this until well afterwards, but they say you make a movie three times: when you write it, when you shoot it, and when you edit it. And that was a very good example of the second time it got made, it was very different than the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had mentioned, you know, technology earlier. This is just changing gears a little bit, but now obviously we're so remote with a lot of things. Production is kind of up and running now back in Hollywood and around the world, but it's different. And certainly for us, we're back up and running, but it's different. What has that been like for you? And like you said, not having the greatest internet or connection at home, how has that transition been?
It's been good and bad. I've directed a couple of commercial projects. I did a commercial project remotely, which was interesting, a bit of a challenge. And I'm kind of glad that I did, because one of the crew members actually tested positive for coronavirus.
Oh my gosh.
I actually took the last 6 months or so. I have been really productive. I took the time and channeled it into writing, and I got two completed screenplays written in the span of like maybe 6-8 months. And I mean, that I've been very, very productive on the writing front. So I've been using the time trying to pivot and still be creative with what I have.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. And I know certainly early on, when kind of all the shoots got, you know, frozen up and or pushed off and things like that, it was amazing, because that's maybe that's another question that we can go into, because you also have your company, Spot Filmworks. But like owning a company, working in the company, there's often a lot of times of working in the company, and then there's working on those other things that you want to do. And certainly John and I got into it because we wanted to tell, you know, stories in feature films or short films. You know, that's kind of like two modes that really spoke to us. And so we got into it, and then people wanted to pay us to do promos and commercials and things like that. So we're like, all right, we'll do that along the way. But, you know, some of those passions go along the wayside when you are so busy. So when everything did slow down, it was great, because I jumped in and I, you know, started working on a script again. You know, we all have several scripts, but I hadn't worked on it in a year or two and was able to get get some good solid time in there. So, I mean, I think that's one of those positive things, is that we can, you know, identify what's important and focus on it. And, you know, hopefully after the world starts going at the speed of light again, we can kind of keep up those efforts, because I'm sure this is resonates with you to some degree. You know, we kind of do some jobs and it's kind of like making donuts, but it's good. And, you know, we need that. But then there's the other stuff that really kind of serves our spirit, or, you know, our heart, or things like that. And being able to keep that going is fundamental to us as creatives, I think.
Yeah. I agree 100%. And I think if to find the time, you know, I'd always beat myself up. It's like, you spend so much time, you know, kind of, you know, looking for the next project to pay the bills, and then you do the work, and I mean, and that is all consuming, and you give 110%, and it's, you know, it's like peaks and valleys, and then, you know, you finish it and you're looking for the next project. And oftentimes the thing that I would, or you're bidding on projects, you know, you've got agencies or clients asking you to bid on things. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say it's a time suck, because that's part of what, that's part of the business and it's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But, the thing that always kind of gets set aside is the thing that got me interested in wanting to tell stories in the first place. And it's as I've gotten older, at first it didn't bother me, but as I've gotten older, it's like, you know, I've been telling stories for other people and for companies and for agencies. And I guess this year with the pandemic and everything, I've gotten to the point where it's like, I want to tell the stories that I wanted to tell, you know, a decade ago. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of grabbing the opportunity, with, it's like the whole world has a pause button in 2020. And it's like, I'm going to use that to force myself into doing the thing that first got me interested, that first kind of lit my passion in the industry. So, I think in that regard, the pandemic has been good for me. Mm-hmm. God forbid if there was a better way for me to reinvent myself, so much the better.
We'll take it.
The wrong impression, but, yeah.
Well, I think part of it is, like, you know, something like what we're in right now forces people out of their routine. And the hope that you have is that hopefully people could see, oh, I actually could make it through without, like, running the rat race at the pace that I was going. You know, like, I actually managed to make it through these last 6-7 months at a slower pace. And maybe I could keep some of those, you know, free time, or I could keep some of those blocks of time to work on projects at home, or, you know, creative projects or family time or whatever it is that you've been doing, and not fall prey to the, like, if I don't keep up this pace and ignore everything that I care about, I won't make it, you know, like,
mm-hmm. I like too, what you were saying, Michael, about, you know, you'd been telling stories for other people, and sometimes really important stories, and in many cases, telling them in really cool, interesting ways that, you know, certainly fill the creative tank, I would assume. But the importance of being able to tell your own stories, and, you know, it might not be your personal life experience, but like the last Indian War, but something that spoke to you, sorry, that sentence structure was incorrect, but something like the last Indian War, which spoke to you and was a story that, you just, you know, it was a part of you in some way, and you needed to help communicate, and thought, hey, I think others could really enjoy and benefit from this. And that's, it's a slight difference in the understanding of, well, somebody didn't just come down and say, hey, make this. This is my thing, and you have to make it your own. It's something that you developed that came out of you, even though it might not be your own historical story or, you know, your own personal struggle.
Sure. To kind of take that one step further, that thought one step further, the thing that's been really interesting, kind of a good learning experience, kind of taking this year and pivoting away from advertising industry to entertainment industry, is when I've been pitching, and I've been doing a lot of virtual pitches, that's actually been kind of a really good thing, is that producers that I didn't have access before, everybody's online on Zoom and Skype now. So it's like getting that opportunity to pitch is easier. Mm-hmm. But it's when you talk to these people, it's what 100% of this is about story. And it's like, and it's all the conversations relate about story, and it's about perfecting the story, and it's still technical writing. I mean, the fact that I have written, I've done some copywriting for advertising and learning to write in a 30-second or 15-second or 60-second format is actually a really good training, because it's, I mean, to write in a technical manner where you're writing about fitting things within a certain amount of time. I mean, it's the same thing in the long format, whether mm-hmm. you're writing an episodic, you know, an episodic for a streamer or for broadcast, you know, you still have to follow the rules and have plot points happen at certain points before commercial breaks or natural breaks, or, you know, a feature still has to have the, you know, plot point between act one and act two and act three happen. And, you know, and the timing of things is still really critical and important. So I think that time, this time spent kind of reacquainting myself with story in a weird way helps me when I do get back to talking to clients about on the advertising side. And there's like this project that I just finished on the advertising side. I think it made me a better director, and even talking about the client's branding story, I think that helps. I think you bring more to the party that way too. So, mm-hmm. I think there's definitely some cross pollination.
Yeah. What do you think, in adapting or marketing for somebody else, what's like the biggest challenge you think? You know, somebody comes to you, they need you to advertise widget A. What's the biggest challenge you think? And, you know, maybe some of those skills you've developed over the years to hit that challenge head on.
I think the challenge, the creative challenge is listening to what the brand is to challenge. You know, depends on how far along, if they are, you know, if the conversation is like directly with a brand and they know what their brand is and they know the story of their brand. I mean, when you're talking to like an ad agency, that kind of happens organically and you're kind of at the tail end of that. So you don't really need to do that. But if you're talking directly with a client, I think it's the challenge is listening to the story and coming up with a really unique way to tell that brand story in a way that kind of rises above the din of the marketplace to make impressions. And I think that's always been the challenge, and it isn't anything new. I mean, advertising's always been that way. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, finding a way to creatively tell a story in a way that resonates and it will create impressions on people that they'll remember. And I think the same is true. There's different terminology, but the same is true in the entertainment industry too. It's telling stories that resonate. and are memorable. And, you know, the end result is different, but, you know, one thing that's been interesting is spending all of this time helping brands figure out their voice. One of the hard things to do as a screenwriter is being told, especially kind of a beginner screenwriter, is having producers ask what my brand is as a writer, and having to like take, you know, basically the conversation that I've had with clients, or that I'm sure you guys have with your clients, and then kind of putting a mirror up to it and kind of turning it onto your own writing. And it's like, because producers and managers and talent agents, everybody wants, you know, they will pigeonhole you as a writer, as a content creator, the same way that, you know, everybody gets pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's an editor, he's a director, you know, he's, you know, on the kind of work that you do. And that's been a really interesting experience the last couple of months too.
Well, and the challenge of that, that's sort of a catch-22, is that we all feel this like, well, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I don't want to be put, you know, like this is the only thing that I can do. But then at the same time, there's a value to that. We do that with our clients and their businesses. It's like, well, what is it that you do? Who's your target audience? And they want to say, well, everyone. Everyone's our audience. And what do? We can do anything. Okay, none of that's interesting. Nobody understands what that means. You know, yeah. I have to know who you are and who you want to talk to. And so then, yeah, as a writer or as a creative, you might want to be like, well, I can do anything. You know, I could be dramatic. I could be funny. I could be action. I could, like, no, that's not a brand. That's not a decision.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so.
And the thing is, like, and when you start, like, if you start being honest with yourself, and it's the same thing, like, when you're asking a client to be honest about their brand and really start thinking about it, you start realizing, well, maybe this widget isn't for everybody. Maybe this widget does, you know, there are certain categories that are stronger. And it's like when, like, looking at my writing, I have experimented with trying a lot of different stories the last two years, from comedy to action thriller. And part of it is like trying to find what my voice is for my brand. And I think, I'm getting a good sense of it finally, but like, you do have to ask yourself those hard questions. And it's like, what are you passionate about? I mean, part of it is answered in the subject matter that you approach. Mm-hmm. John, you said that you've been working on a script. I'm curious would you mind sharing what the story is?
Ooh, the interviewer becomes the interviewee.
That's actually Ryan who said he was working on a script. I have one that has been kicking around in the background forever, but Ryan's the one who...
Yeah, so this, the one that I was mentioning before that I started working on again, it's actually, it's funny, like being in marketing, I get these ideas because they're also marketing based as well. But it's based on a book, a fantasy novel, and it's basically just a little scene of these two running through the forest. It looks like they're, you know, lovebirds, just out for a frolic, but it turns out they're running away from something. And then the night turns sour. And in the book, there's these creatures that come out at night, and there's an old guy, who saves them. And, you know, it plays into all the whole story. So it's like a little short based on this, series of books. And my thought there is a couple things. Like, one, I would love to make movies like this in the future. So let's try to take a small story and tell a small story. But, you know, it's probably a very simple story. And it, you know, I wrote it 4 years ago and have been refining it. And it's kind of to the point now where you just got to, I guess, get off the pot, you know, like, hey, this is probably as good as it can be, you know, having people and friends review it, writing friends, and, you know, just produce it. So that's what I've been working on.
I'm curious, like if you started it 4 years ago, mm-hmm. like your creative choices, did you, as you were rewriting and revisiting it, are there things that you changed to the story? Has the story evolved? Because you're a very different person than you were 4 years ago.
Right. And I think that's one of the problems too, is, you know, every couple of months or every year when I come back to it, there's kind of the style of the time that's really just kind of in my head. And again, that's more marketing related. Like, what am I seeing out there that I think is effective that's new this year? So there are things that have changed. Overall, I think though, I've kept kind of the core story the same. It's kind of some of those extra directorial or producing elements that have changed a little. I have different ways to do different things. By and large, the style is the same. The kind of mood that I've designed for it is the same. And the beats are mostly the same. In some cases, it's just that we have access to a lot better capabilities and can do things in different ways. So I think by and large, the core story is still the same. It's just kind of how we do that changes a little.
Sure. Well, I think it's really important because, like, if you can go back and revisit something, I mean, to me, that's always like a really good way to test the story or test what you're trying to tell or what you're doing, is to kind of let it set it aside for a while, then come back and revisit it. And if you still get excited about it after, you know, months or years, and it's like, oh, I can improve this or I can improve that, but the core stays the same. I think that there's value to that. And I think it's part of the process that shouldn't be, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, I kind of put this away in the shop, you know, and they think that it's something that they did wrong or anything. And it's like, no, I think that's something that should be, you know, it's part of the process that in the evolution of some of the story that helps make it better. And I think it's good that you're doing that. And, you know, I always try to look at things very critically. When I finish a first draft, I'm like so proud that I finished it and I feel good about it. But inevitably, I'll go and I'll put it away and then revisit it. You know, I'll let time in between and I'll go back and reread it and go, what the hell was I thinking? That sucks.
Yeah.
So then it's like, oh, I can make that better. I can make that better. And so it's like, I'm constantly like trying to rewrite and make it better and better. Mm-hmm. And which is a great luxury to have that we don't get in working in advertising. We don't have the deadline, you know, because of the tight turnaround times, we often don't have time to think about it and make it better or stronger, because we have to deliver something in some crazy, you know, some crazy turnaround time. Mm-hmm. So, I my hat's off to you for revisiting your project.
Thank you.
Sometimes we need the time to let that initial perception fade, because I think sometimes there can be an excitement around something that you created because the effort of going from nothing to something is so great that when you see it finished, you suddenly have this pride for the work that was done. Be like, oh, it's something now. It's a tangible thing, and that feels so good that it can be hard to, you know, like this happens internally when we're working on marketing projects. You know, you take that first crack at the creative, and then you present that internally, and it can be hard to start hearing that initial feedback of the things that don't work because it took so much effort to go from the blank page to first draft. But with our own scripts, our own projects, if you're going to be your own critic on it, letting enough time pass to sort of like let that initial excitement fade and then come back, you know, when it's no longer that like, oh great, I got something done, I'm so happy.
Yeah, right. And yeah. Michael, you were mentioning, has it been like 10 years you've been working on The Last Indian War?
10. Yes.
Yeah. So
11 years.
Let me turn it back around to you. What was that like from the first time you wrote it to then coming back and editing for the first time, or even getting somebody else to help edit? Did everything hold up? Like, what was that like? I mean, obviously you're optioning it. It's still around, so it's got that staying power.
Yeah. So, boy.
It's okay. You could be my first draft was terrible.
No, I thought my first draft was, give it to the Library of Congress now. I have written a masterpiece. And, oh my God, it's, my first draft was 146 pages long. And, which is unheard of. It's crazy.
That's a long movie. Yeah.
And everyone was saying, it's like, dude, you 120 pages, man, 2 hours. The rule of thumb is a page a minute. I mean, 120 pages is a 2 hour movie. Mm-hmm. And I wrote 146 and people are like, you're insane. And I was like, no, but every word, on every page is gold. And I had sent it to a couple of film festivals, screenwriting festivals and things. And that early draft, I won best screenplay in Paris at the film festival in Paris that year. It was maybe a year after I finished, within a year of writing it. And they were like, it was really interesting because they said that out of all the categories, that the screenwriting category was the only one that the judges had voted unanimously on. And then they announced Last Indian War, my name. And I was blown away. And it just verified the fact that I had written something that was incredible. But then when we started going around, when I went around, pitching it to people and trying to sell it, the feedback I kept getting 100% of the time was, it's too long. It's too long. Mm-hmm. And I spent, a couple of years, it's like really resisting wanting to edit it down and to change it. And then the first time it was optioned, I did do a little bit of a rewrite, and I went through and I think I knocked down maybe 5 pages. I knocked it down. And I tinkered with it, and there was some of the notes I was getting were actually genuinely really good notes. They're like, you have this major plot point, but it happens 35 minutes in. Can we have this happen earlier? And I was like, and the more I thought about it, I was like, that's actually really, really good note. And so in the process of rewriting that, it got a little bit shorter. It wasn't until maybe 4 or 5 years. It was probably 4 years ago when I really, I take that back. It was really within the last year or two when seriously getting it out there to producers and hearing all of it, in the one note, and it's like, you got to kind of take notes with a grain of salt. Some of the notes you get back from people, they're like, they're so out there and so crazy. And it's I'm going to ignore that. But, my manager, he tells this great story. He goes, taking notes is a lot. The story he tells, he goes, if you're at a party and somebody tells you that you've had too much to drink to stop drinking, tell them to fuck off. But if 30 people come up to you and tell you to stop drinking, call a cab. And that was kind of like applied. Was telling me shorten the damn story. So I spent a lot of time shortening it, cutting it down to, I got it to 120. I think it's 121 pages now. And part of it was just changing the way I write, because I was writing in my scene descriptions. I was actually writing notes for me as a director. Mm-hmm. And I had to kind of change my perspective to keep it just about the action, just about the story and the action. So my scene descriptions got shorter, but I also, in the process, learned to, you know, what is the, what if I'm, you know, what is the story I'm trying to tell? And I was able to edit things down, tighten it up, keep the focus on the story and the dialogue without losing any of the major scenes. There was one scene I to this day, I regret cutting out. It was really, really good. I kind of took out some characters and combined some characters, but I think it's a lot tighter now. And kind of getting back to your comment about, you know, all the energy that it takes to go from nothing to creating something, it's, you know, I wholeheartedly agree with that. It, you know, it's like when you get in the car and you're all the energy that it takes to go from zero to 50, it's like, and that's just to get you up to speed, mm-hmm. which is great, but it's not fun until you can go from 50 to 80. And it's, so you kind of have to burn all that energy to get up to speed. And then once you're up to speed, you can, I think that's where a lot of the really good creative things happen. When you're forced to go back and examine your first ideas and to either say, no, yes, those are good ideas, or I can make it better. Same thing like with presenting things on the advertising side. It's, I think that, you know, having clients challenge you to come back and revisit ideas makes them stronger strategically, I think. And it's hard. That was a hard lesson for me to always learn. I didn't want to do that. There was a time when I was like, no, this is genius. And now, oh, what a dope I was.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because, and maybe it's very different in the writing, and you can talk about that versus the actual directing and producing. You know, that's the second and the third of the three times you make a film. And certainly I feel like I've gotten to a place emotionally where, you know, I can earnestly pitch my idea, which I think is going to be the best, but having a discussion where a few times, you know, we're told no, 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 you know, I can get over that because, you know, part of it is me acknowledging, like, it's not about me per se. You know, they came to us because they want us to tell their story, but it's not about me and this one idea, you know. And part of just being a filmmaker, and this is less on the writing side and more on the filmmaking side, is adapting to any of the circumstances that come up. You know, like, you may have the best laid plans, but come that day, you know, something is late, like a key element is late. And so you have to either adjust the schedule or figure out how to adjust the script. And at the same time, you're dealing with the agency or the client saying, well, why is this? So, you know, you're managing all these things and it's so super fluid. And that's part of that. It gets made on, you know, a second time. And then on the third, you know, when you're editing it, you have not complete control, but you have major control over kind of the guiding principle of it. So with you wearing those kind of two different hats, being a writer that, you know, you're potentially handing off a project and somebody's just going to run away with it, you obviously have experience with that first film. But how has that been for you, you know, just thinking, okay, I think I have this really great story and this best idea, and it's going to get taken away and done by somebody else, and it's probably going to transform a little bit.
Yeah, it will transform. And that's the important lesson to learn, is it will. I mean, boy, even like on the directing side, there's been things that, I mean, that when you're on set and you're shooting, that at the time, I mean, that, like, there's things I'm really proud of, and you get into the editing suite and it's like, oh, great, now you have a 33-second commercial. Mm. And it's like, oh, you know, we've got to cut some, you know, we've got to, the things that tend to get cut in, for me, are some of the emotional connections that connect characters together. For the sole reason is it doesn't fit within the format. And I mean, how many times does your first edit come in at, you know, 35, 40 seconds mm-hmm. or when it's got to be 30? And it's the thing that you're tightening up is it's like you're getting the story down to the core and you're sacrificing some of the things that kind of flesh out the story. And so it's like that applies, I think, across the board in, you know, whether it's short form storytelling or long form storytelling. Right. I don't think I answered your question. I think I went off on a crazy tangent.
Yeah, no, that's okay. This is just how it works. And I'm off on this tangent with you because, I mean, you talked about it earlier, but it's such a important skill. And like, I would maybe even encourage people who are like, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a director. It's like, okay, let's give you the, you know, the shortest kind of projects that are out there, like a 15, like tell me an emotional story in a 15. Once you've kind of learned how to do that, then you can step it up and then you can be responsible and tell a, you know, hour and 20 minute story without losing us after 15 minutes because, you know, you don't know how to keep that pace going, which is like you identified, you still have those same elements. It's just in a different time frame.
Right. Right. I tell you, I think the best training for a director is in advertising because it forces you to be collaborative. It isn't like film school where you're, you know, the cult of the director, the auteur. Mm-hmm. You have to collaborate and you have to listen to a lot of different voices with a lot of different political agendas and deliver something that is effective and works. And you have to collaborate. And also, if you can make an emotional connection in 30 seconds, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's comedy or something that's really heartfelt, if you can make an emotional connection in that short amount of time, good on you, man. That's a really, really hard thing to do. And I think it's actually easier to get an audience involved in a story in an emotional way when you've got more time than you do when you've got 30 seconds or 15 or 60 seconds. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great training run. And you realize that every frame counts. There was a young editor who interned for me a couple of years ago. He wanted to crack at editing a project we had worked on. And his first cut came in, it was like a 60 second. It was even maybe a little longer than a 60 second. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's great. And I said, okay, now this has to be a 30 second. And he looked at me and he goes, there's no way. There's no way that we can make this, that it can be a 30 second and tell the same story. And I just grinned and I said, it has to be. Yeah. You don't have an option.
Yeah.
And
you're like, step aside, Padawan.
Yeah. He went back. He was so disappointed. And what he had done was actually really good. I mean, he was a very talented editor mm-hmm. and he had done a really, really good job. But to go back and try to cut that down to 30, and he did, and he discovered that he could do it and it did work. But I think that's a really important lesson to learn is that you are trying to fit things into a certain amount of time. And if you're doing something like, if you're going to do like a streaming series or something, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got a set amount of time to do and you're working in a, you know, if you're working on an episodic, you're working in a writer's room with a lot of different personalities and a different agendas. And you're just applying it. You know, it's just a different scenario, but you're still applying the same skill set.
Mm-hmm. I feel like some of the things that I've picked up over the years probably get me in trouble when I'm just having regular conversations with my wife, my family, because in my head, I feel sometimes like I've got this this editor going just like unnecessary details, get to the next thing.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I'm so glad you said that because I have the same thing goes on in my head.
But I've experienced that watching, I can't remember what movie it was, but I remember watching something recently and thinking like, I'm not ready to be at this point emotionally where they like tried to take us in the story. You know, I was like, because they were cramming too much action in or whatever. And I was like, I don't even know the characters yet. And then we're like suddenly supposed to be here, you know, emotionally with them. And it's just kind of those shorter form things teach you that, like, you know, maybe we don't need all that action to happen. Maybe we need to skip some of those details and give me another moment with this person so that I get to know them and that I'm ready to go on that. Right. I'm ready to care about them.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Yeah. I feel I'm so happy that you brought that up, John and Michael, that it resonated with you. Cause I'll joke with my wife. She'll start revving up on a story. And I'm like, hang on. What's the point? Like what's the thing that I'm supposed to take away? Like, I understand that 2 years ago, this and that, and now today, and then you were thinking, but then this, and I'm like, you know, we have limited, it's the editor in my mind. I'm like, we have limited time together. Let's use that wisely. What's the most important part? So I get a lot of crap for that as well, which is probably appropriate.
But I mean, professionally though, you need that.
Oh yeah.
You need
yeah.
that skill to be able to get to the point.
Yeah.
People's time is valuable and, you know, and people's attention spans are short. So you need to be able to really pitch the creative in a real succinct way and get to the point of the matter, and get them hooked. And it's a hard skill to learn. And when you see it not done well, it kind of reinforces the fact that it's like, oh, yeah.
The importance of it. Yeah. So we are kind of wrapping up here. I do want to kind of respect your time. As we kind of slow down a little bit, we asked this last week. Somebody had the question, so I wanted to ask you as well. What's like one of the greatest challenges like you're currently facing, and how are you addressing it? And this could be, you know, in anything. It could be very specifically production. It could be, you know, life work balance. Although I feel like everyone's had a good reboot the last 9 months or whatever.
Whoa. Biggest challenge.
It's a real moment here.
Yeah. What's your biggest challenge?
Oh boy.
I'm peddling. I'm
like, yeah, that's okay. I'll give you a second to answer while I talk, or you can think while I talk. I think it's kind of one of the things we talked about today, and then the second thing that I just brought up now. And the first is, you know, remembering why we're doing it, you know, why I'm in this field and what I want to do, and keeping that in mind, because even, you know, during COVID, keeping the company together and being successful took some extra doing. But, you know, what is all the point of it? Like, why are we doing this? So keeping that in mind and actively working towards that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges, like working on that other script or doing some other creative stuff. And, you know, you have a business meeting and you ask each other, you know, there's three of us partners, and we ask like, okay, what's the ROI on that? And that's a good question, but we also have to be okay with the answer, you know, it's my goal, or, you know, my creative soul like needs to do this type of thing. And I think we have a good team that can respond well to that. But I know when we get busy, it's really hard to think about those things and do those other things. So, I mean, this is actually one of those things that I started early on. We've been doing a podcast, but then I got this going, and it takes some time each week. But it's like, I just need to talk to people, and I need to create something that is not, I'm not being told what to do by a client. There's not a, you know, more specific, if I do this, then I will get this type of ROI. There's certainly ROI on having these discussions, but for me, it's more of kind of a personal outlet. And so kind of making sure I keep my eye on that and allow others in the company to do that as well. Is one of them the biggest challenges. And then the other thing is just work-life balance. And it comes and it goes. Like, there's busy seasons, there's not busy seasons. But through it all, again, kind of keeping your why in mind or your goal in mind. And part of that, you know, for me is faith and family. And intertwined with that is the creative that I want to do as well. So it's kind of the same as the first thing. So that was a long-winded answer.
No, there's a lot of wisdom in that answer, I think. And I think that challenge, I mean, a lot of, I think everyone is struggling with that, at least a lot of creatives. This year has been really challenging. I've seen a lot of people, a lot of creative people I know struggle. A lot of creative people that I've worked with over the years and ad agencies that have gotten laid off, mm-hmm. that have lost their jobs, that are burned out, that struggle with, especially as you get older, you know, you do burn out and, you know, trying to maintain the passion that keeps creativity, you know, those fires burning. Mm-hmm. And I think that a challenge is trying to find the balance. So you talk about ROI, it's trying to find that balance where you've got, you know, the return on the investment that's financial. So, but it's finding the balance where it allows you to feel, to get that return on your investment that is creative capital. And I think the hardest thing for me has been finding a balance for that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've told people, I kind of get on a soapbox. There was a great book I read called The Gift. And it was kind of like an epiphany for me. And it talked about the fact that we live in, there are two different economies at play in society. There's the market-driven economy, which in the United States drives almost everything. But there's also something called the gift economy. And the gift economy is economy where something doesn't take on value unless it's given away. And for example, education, healthcare, the creative arts, these all are things that function best in the gift economy. And a great example, like a real basic example, is, you know, if your house catches on fire and you only can grab one thing out of your house, what is it going to be? You know, 9 times out of 10, people will say a photo album, mm-hmm. or, you know, this thing that my child, you know, these drawings that my kid made that were on my refrigerator. And it's like in the market-driven economy, that model, those things don't have any value. I mean, some pieces of paper with crayon drawn on them, mm-hmm. but the fact that they were a gift to you gives them an added value to that makes it really precious and unique and invaluable. And, you know, I think when we work with creatives, you know, I've always told people, like interns and things for years, and people like freelancers that are starting out, you know, take a project for two reasons. You either do it for the money or you do it for your reel. Mm-hmm. And if you're really lucky, you can do it for both. And you get something that is creative and real worthy that highlights your work, mm-hmm. and also get paid for it. And I think kind of building on that, you know, the hardest thing for me between doing the work that pays the bills and has that investment, but also finding the I can build the creative capital. And the past year, it's been really hard. Everyone's separated. You can't, because it's collaborative. We work in a collaborative business. That's been the thing that I think I missed the most and that I really would appreciate the most. once this is all over. But I think it's finding that balance.
Mm-hmm. And you still haven't answered my question. What's your biggest challenge? But I will just follow up with that real quick. I think we do end up with fantastic clients because we put such weird content out there that people see that and they come to us and like, hey, we want you to do something like that, which is great. And so like I have an animation project where at the end, the VO is like, what you don't know about the Smiths is actually they're lizard people. And it's like informational for a power company. So, you know, I don't want to throw shade. That's kind of my phrase of the week on the fact that we get to work with great clients on great things, but there's something mental. It's like a mental failing of, okay, somebody hired me to do this, so I'm kind of beholden to them and their ideas versus I can do anything with this creative thing. The reality is they're functionally exactly the same. It's just that mental understanding of who's in charge that's changing that perspective. But hopefully you've had a chance now to think about your biggest challenge.
I think it is finding that balance between the between the creative capital and the financial capital. That's been the hardest. I'm kind of at the place where I don't want to give up doing the commercial work. Mm-hmm. But I really do want to try to keep that part of what I've been doing really close to me.
Sure.
But at the same time, also expand over here and try to do both. And I'm hopeful that I can do both, but I think that's the biggest challenge is trying to keep both close to me.
Well, and maybe in like a year or two, you can teach a masterclass on that. Cause I think that's like the big challenge, you know, that's what we all desire. I like to say that I'm a filmmaker with a agency habit. You know, I like to keep it in that order, even though my marketing and agency work is way more than any type of filmmaking work, but that just in my head keeps that straight. Like, no, I am, this is who I am. And I have this habit of helping other people market their products.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. Do you think of yourself when you introduce yourself to someone else, do you, introduce yourself as a filmmaker or do you introduce yourself as a storyteller or as an advertiser? How do you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I've been talking a lot. John, why don't you answer that question first?
I try not to. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, back to an earlier point we were saying, it's funny because, you know, when you turn those questions around on yourself, I would be a bad client for myself because I try not to answer that question. I try not to put the label on it. We've bounced around a lot in our company, you know, moving around in the roles, you know, like I was the lead editor for a while until we were finally able to hire an editor. And now I like barely edit at all. So, and then I find myself in other roles. That's actually a really hard question for me to answer. I'll use that to answer a different question. That's my biggest challenge right now.
Good.
You know, but I guess what I was going to say, which won't be an answer still, is just that at some point we decided that it would be best for us not to try to hide who we are or fool other people into thinking that we're more corporate than we are or that we're more whatever, because at some point, if we land the job, you're going to start working with us and you're going to find out actually this is what we're like. This is who we are. And it was a good move to make because when people come work with us, they know that we're going to be kind of pushing on these creative levers to try to get, you know, we've actually been very fortunate to get a lot of clients that come to us with, quote, corporate video projects that have allowed us to do crazy and wild things because we're like pushing the boundary saying, hey, this will be more fun, more interesting if people, you know, if we do this. So we've had a few projects that I feel like we've actually been able to hit, not perfectly, but as close as you can to the combination of doing it for the real and for the budget or for the money.
Real, you know, like, and the meal.
Yeah, we get paid for it, but we've been able to do something really goofy and crazy with it. And then the best is at the end of the day when you come back and you're just like, I can't believe we just made an 80s action movie with ninjas for a dehumidifier company.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to say filmmaker. I so much do, but I feel like growing up through the business, we were Backflip Films. Now we're just Backflip, but people are like, oh, you make video. Interesting. You know, it was kind of looked down upon. And so I never wanted to say anything that would have anyone pity me, you know, and maybe that's the ego in me or something, but I always, you know, wanted to be looked upon favorably, right? You know, you don't want people to hate you. You want people to love you. And so even recently, I kind of downplay it. Like if somebody wants to have a conversation, I will 100% go into this conversation. But if they're like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I work in marketing. Because, you know, we're all storytellers, but to some degree, that has been over-marketed. We're storytellers, visionary storytellers. And so like John and I have like a little aversion to that word, despite that being the core of what we are. So I think of the marketing of it. I say like, oh yeah, you know, I work in marketing. Well, what do you do? Well, I'm a creative director at, you know, this marketing firm, and, you know, we get to do a lot of really great commercial and, you know, this product. And then I can also explain kind of the film, experience that I have or have worked on. I would love to just be like, I'm a filmmaker. But I guess I have some of that mental baggage that I just need to get over before I'm ready to do that.
Yeah, I struggle with it too. And it's funny, I always struggled with the term video. I always struggled with. And I think part of it, when I had first moved here and was working for the production company was called RW Video. And I never talked to the guys at Pro Video if they had the same thing happen. But oftentimes, and this is, you know, a number of years ago, the world is different now, but the reception, we would get phone calls at RW Video of people wanting to rent video, like thinking it was Blockbuster Video. And and I was like, note to self, don't put video in the name of your company.
Oh my gosh.
Your company.
100%. That's why we called ourselves Backflip Films, because that elicited this idea of story and, you know, just so much more than video, even though film and video are analog, you know, descriptions or similar descriptions.
But I think we jumped on to a film is a thing that is creative. It tells a story, and video, like you could have a video of a cat running down the street. Like,
right.
It seems to have some different meaning that we were trying to target.
Yeah. So what does your card say, Michael? I know you have, I think it's writer and filmmaker on one of the websites.
I struggle. I really struggle with this for years and years. I just had director.
Sure.
And that was fine. And I think same thing, like the company who Spot Filmworks. Mm-hmm. And, as the years went by, the company is technically still called Spot Filmworks, but I think on the website we dropped Filmworks and it just says Spot. Maybe it doesn't. I have to check. I should check. I haven't even looked at my notes. I've been struggling of late of, you know, it's like for people that aren't in our industry, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you're a director. Oh, you know, and they don't know if what a producer is and a director. They don't, it's like, sometimes you don't want to get into any of that.
Or they'd be like, oh, have I seen any of your movies? And you're like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's always the follow up. Nope, you've seen my work.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got bigger audiences than a lot of feature directors. I've had projects that have debuted during the Super Bowl. So I struggle with that, and I don't know. The card that I have right now, I think I put, content creator, which I hate. I hate that term. And I think it says director, writer, content director, or content creator. And I struggle. A filmmaker, I think I'm with you, man. That seems like the most poetic and passionate thing to put up there.
Yeah.
And I've kind of resisted doing it, and I don't know why. So that's why I was really curious to see what you guys kind of your take on it is. Yeah.
Well, the other term we've gone with a lot lately that feels pretty good is creative director, because we're not, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing is not always in film. And I think that's the hesitation. It's like saying, hi, I'm a filmmaker and I'm going to do your website, you know, like, but throwing in creative director is like, you know, we're behind the creative process on all these different projects. Obviously that's a term that gets used over in agencies that are more traditional type agencies, but it feels like it still works in the film side for me. So
that's funny too, because I run our web department over here, because I have experience at other companies doing this type of work. However, now that the question has been posed, I would never introduce myself as like, I'm the webmaster or the director of, you know, web services or anything like that, because it's part of that identity. Like, and I actually love doing web stuff. Like, it's kind of like a hobby as well. So like filmmaking and technology are like my hobbies.
But it's one component. It's not the sum of what you do.
Right. And people, you know, understand certain things and like, hey, I'm a filmmaker. Oh, what movies have you made? Okay. Well, that's not super communicative to most people what that is. So what is something? Yeah. So I think both of mine and John's, and that's how I introduced myself on this podcast or whatever, is creative director. Because people understand that a little bit better in marketing, but I don't know. Yeah, we got to figure this out.
Yeah. Well, maybe, and you know, I think at heart I'm a Luddite, so I think maybe that's why it's like the whole writing thing appeals to me, mm-hmm. because a writer is a writer, and it's like I really kind of welcome that, but it doesn't describe everything that I do, mm-hmm. and you know, and it's hard, you know, and I don't like hyphens. I know we live in kind of a hyphen world where you have to have hyphens.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. I'm all things to all people. Is that a...
But you can't be. I know.
Yeah, it doesn't work in the brand exercise.
Yeah. Sometimes I think, well, what kind of title would I give myself that would outlive a meltdown of society?
Carpenter.
But storyteller, although like Ryan said, we've been averse to be overly, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
You just got
It's like in these unprecedented times, like after 1 week of commercials like that, I was like, oh gosh, we never did it. We got to make a spoof of this, because everyone's tired of hearing unprecedented, new normal, now more than ever, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
every 10 years, every generation has unprecedented challenges that have to be met.
But that would be, you know, but that would be maybe more, you know, one of the more accurate titles because again, I've had these mental exercises as you're watching cities burn and pandemics rage. Be like, okay, so what am I going to do post society? And it's like, well, I don't know. Maybe I could just tell stories, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stand there and tell somebody a story in exchange for a bag of rice.
Well, and again, there's value to that. And that gets back to that part of that gift economy. And there's an old Hopi Indian proverb that says, those who tell the stories rule the world. And I always thought that was kind of a cool thing. But we're storytellers, but it's that can be a little pretentious too, because there's so many bad storytellers.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's like there's so many bad storytellers and bad stories. So it's like,
I really love storytellers. I just, you know, it's like the over-marketing of it. Like, I wouldn't feel bad telling someone I'm a storyteller except for the over, you know, the way it's just overused, because then that's an easy conversation. Like, oh, what do you do? Well, here's the whole universe of things, you know, like small promos, marketing materials, websites, commercials, short films, feature films, documentary films, you know, and what's at the core of that? Like, so our shtick is let's make awesome. And the idea is like, it doesn't matter if it's this long, that size, here's our constraints. Like if it's a construction fan, we want it to be awesome. You know, we want it to move people and transform hearts and minds regardless of the format. And so I do like storytellers, but I don't know that I could like you said, it can be a little pretentious too.
Maybe we go with rulers of the world.
Yes. The old Hopi proverb is,
like,
we're
that.
Rulers of the world. Yeah. That's awesome. All right. Well, this has been so awesome, Michael. Thank you so much for coming on. I would love to have you back, and maybe we'll do it later in the day and we could actually be in person at some point. Like that's my hope too, is we can, you know, hang out and do this in person. Because the one thing that I dislike about online stuff is just always waiting for somebody to finish. Cause I'm like a puppy, like ready, like, oh yeah, that's so amazing. Let me add some more thoughts. And then what are you thinking? Like, it's so fast and interactive in my mind, but you're always kind of waiting, like, wait, are they going to talk? Are they not going to talk? So I can't wait to be in person, and we'll definitely have you in as soon as we can for that.
This was a blast, and thank you for inviting me, and I would love to do it again. And in person is great. I'll even bring a bottle of JMO.
Oh my gosh. That sounds amazing. I think that's the requirement. Anybody who's going to come into the studio, you know, has to bring the libations. I love that. So is there anything you would like to plug or share? Because I want this to be an advertisement for you, a moment to share all your things.
Oh boy. I want to share, I hope everyone has a very safe and joyous and wonderful holiday, in whatever form it takes. And, you know, and it's like, be creative, man, fight the good fight, be passionate, find your passion, and don't let anyone tell you no, don't do it.
I love that. I'm going to keep telling myself that over the next couple of weeks while I'm not sitting at my work desk. Thank you so much for that. Let's see. Yeah. We're out next week. We're not here. So you can't watch us. I should probably write this stuff down, you know, to take us out of these things, but we'll be back the following week. Don't know who the guest is. Emily will tell me when we have that next guest ready. We'll advertise that. It's going to be fun. Yes, like Michael said, please do have a safe, joyous Christmas, Hanukkah, all your holidays. We wish you Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Thank you, Michael. This was so much fun. And John, anything else to lead us out here?
nope, that's it.
Well, someday we have to do a show of us being very awkward. I think that'd be really fun. No, that's fantastic. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.